Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning, February 25th. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. Well, this morning on The Old Mole, Laurie Mercier talks with Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. They provide news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. They'll discuss this morning an electoral strategy for the left. What's a socialist to do? Do any Democrat candidates offer a possibility for real change? Tom Becker will share an article written by Robert Hunsaker for the Counterpunch, An Unforeseen Climate Beast Awakens, focusing on East Antarctica. Bill Resnick talks with Larry Kleinman. He's a co-founder of PICUN, Oregon's farm worker union. They will discuss the big picture, the national and state picture, Trump's strengthening of the anti-immigrant movement, how he maintains power, his impact on migrants, and the pro-immigrant movement, their responses, gains, and strategies. And to conclude the show, I will be looking at a film, Made in L.A., which will be playing as part of a Democratic Socialists of America Portland chapter movie night on March 3rd. I'll talk a little bit about the film and give some insights from some of the event organizers. Again, I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll turn now to Laurie Mercier and Glenn Ford.
Thanks, Denise. It's a great honor to have with us Glenn Ford, who is a dean of Black journalism, having worked as reporter, producer, and creator of forums for Black voices since the 1970s in print, radio, television, and the internet. He co-founded Black Commentator in 2002, which quickly became the most influential Black political site on the internet. And in October 2006, Ford and others left Black Commentator to launch BlackAgendaReport.com, where he is the executive editor and provides news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. The Black Agenda Report is one of our favorite websites on the Old Mole Variety Hour, so we're really happy to have you here. Glenn Ford, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks so much for the invitation.
You have a recent piece in Black Agenda Report that claims that Bernie Sanders is trying to steal the rich man's party. What do the ruling class find so frightening about Sanders' run?
Well, the consensus among the ruling class, and it's a hard and fast consensus, is for austerity and war, endless austerity and endless war. What Bernie Sanders is doing is pushing for super supermajority of proposals. That is, there is a consensus among the American electorate around Medicare for All, which commands the allegiance of about 85% of the Democratic Party and even majorities of the Republican Party, and for free higher education, and now this Green New Deal proposal, which also commands supermajority support and about half of the Republican Party. So here we have a ruling class whose primary party, by the way, now is the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is the party that expresses the consensus of the ruling class. And so we have a Democratic Party controlled by a ruling class that is demanding, imposing forever austerity and war, and a populace that is squarely on the side of the proposals that are personified by Bernie Sanders. So they are on a collision course.
So you, many of your pieces emphasize that Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and others who are left-leaning within the Democratic Party are not real socialists, but really more like social democrats on the European model, and identify themselves with policies that are more akin to the New Deal Democrats, or you might say Great Society Democrats. Democratic political party has not really embraced for many decades. But why would these fairly mild proposals for Medicare for All, free higher education, why would those be so threatening?
Because the ruling class consensus is for endless austerity. And it's the same in Europe, which is causing the social breakdowns, the deterioration of relations between the people and the state in Europe. Europe's ruling class also is for endless austerity and for acceptance of the U.S.'s endless wars. So that's why they are at loggerheads. You know, Medicare for All would actually be a beneficial in the short term, in the immediate term, a beneficial program for all businesses that employ lots of people, because it decreases the cost of labor to the company. But almost all business groupings oppose it, and they oppose it because they are for austerity, and Medicare for All is seen as a kind of Pandora's box. Once you allow that kind of entitlement to be enacted, then you're opening up the floodgates to all the other entitlements that would follow. And so they oppose Medicare for All, as well as the rest of the agenda. So that's their hard and fast position. It is the ruling class consensus, and they're not going to brook any compromise with it.
But you also note that supporting these proposals would undoubtedly unleash pressures to dramatically shrink the war budget. But is that part of this new social democratic movement to dramatically decrease the war budget?
No, and we can see it in practice in the way the Democrats caved, not only accepting the biggest war budget in history, but accepting a war budget that was bigger than what Trump asked for the last time around. It's the great contradiction in what passes for a left in the United States, that they are pro-imperialist. In real socialist terms, we call these folks social imperialists. They want something like social democracy for their own populations while waging predatory wars on working class people around the world. They have no solidarity in their socialism.
And certainly that's represented by the lack of action or speaking out against the intervention in Venezuela and the planned coup in Venezuela.
Oh, of course. Bernie Sanders described the late Hugo Chavez as a dead communist dictator. Venezuela has had more free and fair elections not only than the United States, but more in the 21st century than any country in the world. It is probably demonstrably the most bourgeois democratic government in the world, having put its constitutional revisions and countless elections to the popular test and passed that test over and over again. But Bernie Sanders joins the corporate media chorus, the whole bourgeois Mormon tabernacle choir of lies about Venezuela.
However, I mean, to Sanders' credit, he did speak out against intervention, didn't he?
Yeah.
One can hope for in the American political scene, out against intervention, even while condemning the so-called dictator.
That's right. He's less of an aggressive imperialist. His latest statement on Venezuela warns against the more muscular kind of U.S. imperialism, while at the same time lying about Venezuela and essentially giving a justification for some kind of move against Venezuela. We used to call that wishy-washy, but when literally millions of Venezuelan lives and Latin American lives is at stake, wishy-washy is far too weak a word for these social imperialists of the so-called left.
Well, what are ways that the Democratic Party are attempting to sabotage Sanders' campaign, especially with any number of candidates who have announced their run for the presidency?
Well, first, it's the rush of early candidacies that we saw. It was as if the Democratic Party and its corporate media backers were in a panic to show that Sanders is irrelevant, that he's left the train. Look, we've already got a full-blown cast of characters. We've got two black senators out there. And so it was very, very clear that the early major project of the Democrats was to preempt Sanders. And that meant actually not mentioning him, if at all possible, in the corporate media. It was if Sanders wasn't in the room when he, in fact, was the 5-ton gorilla in the room, the specter that they were all terrified of.
Well, clearly the Democratic establishment sees the African-American vote as key to propelling particular candidates forward. And you've been particularly critical, I think, of Kamala Harris. What are her flaws?
Actually, from the beginnings of the Black Commentator and throughout the history of Black Agenda Report, we've been most critical of Cory Booker. Cory Booker is almost a laughable prospect in if he's to be characterized as some kind of progressive Democrat. He comes from the most reactionary circles of the Democratic Party. Back at the turn of the 21st century, Cory Booker was running two private schools in Newark. He was an advocate of private school vouchers. He was an early founder of these front organizations for hard right corporatist Betsy DeVos forces out there who were defending segregation academies. This is before charter schools became the favorite of the school privatizers. And Cory Booker was deeply allied with them. They're the folks who provided the millions of dollars that gave him national prominence in his first and second runs for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. That's what made him one of the great black hopes and a potential of having been of becoming the first Obama. But Kamala Harris is the front runner in terms of being the black candidate to derail Bernie Sanders, not Cory Booker. And that's why we've paid more attention to her early campaign.
But historically, there is this black tradition of skepticism of power, and you've written about how black Americans, for the most part, are in huge majorities against U.S. imperial adventures. They're They're more wise to the kind of corporate takeover of the U.S. So why would most African-Americans in the country be persuaded by some of these faux progressive candidates?
Because the duopoly system is a trap that in the end compels black Democrats to vote against their own very left-wing political inclinations. The two-party system is, in fact, a one-party system for black people because one of the parties is always the white man's party, a party that is white supremacist and for which white supremacy is the main organizing principle, and that is the Democratic Party. The Republican Party. So therefore, there is only, in terms of the duopoly, the Democratic Party. And black folks' first priority is to defeat the white man's party. And so in Democratic primaries, and this is the great irony and symptomatic of the trap, black Democrats vote for the candidate that they believe is best suited to defeat the white man's party. And that usually means the best financed and funded candidate, which turns out to be the corporate candidate. So even though black folks, by all measures and for generations, have clearly been the most left-wing and the most anti-war and pro-peace constituency in the United States, they tend in these primaries to vote for the corporate candidate.
And one can understand that need for belief in self-preservation as sort of necessary actions. But Glenn Ford, in the remaining minutes that we have, what's a socialist to do given the duopoly and the electoral process such as it is in this country? What do you find as hopeful signs or models for organizing?
Well, I think that this election has great promise. I want to make it very clear that nobody at Black Agenda Report is a Democrat, and all of us are anti-imperialists, and all of us are socialists, and there is zero possibility that we would wind up endorsing a Democrat. But our job is to provide analysis.
Yes.
And our analysis is that this election could be very, very productive for the left. I personally believe that there is no way in hell that the main party now of the ruling class, the Democrats, are going to allow their consensus on endless austerity and war to be busted by Bernie Sanders. And they are going to undermine and sabotage his campaign in ways that are so blatant, so public, so undemocratic that millions of people who thought that the only way to move is to be a Democrat will be so damn disgusted that we'll see a radicalization of unprecedented numbers of people, providing the human capital that can make a real struggle for peace and socialism possible.
Glenn Ford, thank you so much for joining us today. And we want to remind listeners to check out the Black Agenda Report. It's a fantastic website full of news, commentary, and analysis, such as you've heard today from Glenn Ford. Thanks again.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris, this morning. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and Glenn Ford. Fantastic conversation there. You'll be able to hear that on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. That'll be posted along with the rest of the programming later this week. We will hear from Bill Resnick talking with Larry Kleinman, co-founder of Picoon, later in our program, and I will be discussing the film Made in L.A., which will be showing at the Clinton Street Theater on March 3rd as part of DSA Portland's movie night opening Women's History Month. We'll now hear from Tom Becker. He will be sharing an article written by Robert Hunziker, An Unforeseen Climate Beast Awakens.
Good morning. One of the most frightening aspects of climate change is that estimates of its pace of advancement have been grossly underestimated by climate scientists. Today I'm sharing an article entitled An Unforeseen Climate Beast Awakens by Robert Hunziker. East Antarctica is a big-time global warming player. Nothing is comparable. It is the world heavyweight, and nothing can impact the world with so much calamitous clout. As such, it would be a huge mistake to discount its capability to turn mean-spirited, striking all of a sudden, catching scientists and humanity unawares. In fact, it is already turning heads, and it alone is equivalent to 170 feet of water. Disturbingly, early signals of destabilization have been detected at Totten Glacier, East Antarctica, where according to accepted science for years and years, we are not supposed to worry until the next century. Scientists have always said East Antarctica is a not-to-worry region, nearly impervious to the impact of climate change. However, along those lines, over time, it's becoming increasingly evident that one of the horrors of the global warming story is a failure of mainstream science to know what's really going on in a timely fashion, always late to the party. Repercussions could be cascading ecosystems, crushing societal norms, and flooding of the great cities well ahead of any kind of preparations, such as building dikes around major urban centers. Here's what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, the prototype of mainstream science light, has said regarding the outlook for Antarctica. In 1995, the IPCC projected little change in the extent of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets over the next 50 to 100 years. The 2001 IPCC report suggested that neither the Greenland nor the Antarctic ice sheets would lose significant mass by 2100. The 2007 IPCC report said there were uncertainties in the full effects of changes in ice sheet flow, and suggesting that partial loss of the ice sheets on polar land could imply meters of sea level rise. Such changes are projected to occur over millennial timescales. The reality is very different. Furthermore, the 2014 IPCC report said that Antarctica's contribution to rising sea levels would not exceed several tenths of a meter during the 21st century. Wrong again. The fate of the world's coastlines has become a classic example of how the IPCC, when confronted with conflicting science, tends to go for the least drama position. Yet extraordinarily, the 2014 IPCC assessment report repeated the mistake and actually produced a numerically smaller figure, despite mounting evidence of a polar ice mass loss. Meanwhile, as the IPCC twiddled its thumbs, West Antarctica's meltdowns turned serious, losing three massive ice shelves in 1995, 2002, and 2017. The third loss, a 1 trillion ton behemoth, forcing National Geographic to redraw the world atlas. Somebody noticed. Now there's this. The Totten Glacier in East Antarctica is destabilizing. It alone carries enough ice to melt 16 feet to flood New York City and Tokyo. Forget Miami. It's a goner. Totten is less than 10% of the mass of East Antarctica. Still, Totten alone brings more potential sea level rise than all of West Antarctica, where major destabilization of glaciers continues ongoing with gusto. According to a recent telling article in Geophysical Research Letters, Totten lost 18 billion tons of ice every single year from 2002 to 2016, a clear signal that risk of inordinate sea level rise is now officially on the move. Quoting from the article, both of these glaciers, the others being the oddly named Moscow University Glacier, are vulnerable to the intrusion of warm ocean water and hold considerable potential for sea level rise. The work highlights that East Antarctica glaciers are as important to our future as those of the continent's western regions. End quote. The ecosystem degradations have a potential to come down like a ton of bricks on civilized society. For overall perspective, Antarctica is the world's largest desert at 5,400,000 square miles. It is the highest, driest, coldest, windiest, brightest of the seven continents, roughly the size of the United States and Mexico combined, and almost completely covered by a layer of ice that averages more than 1 mile in thickness and up to 3 miles in some areas. The ice has accumulated over millions of years through snowfall. It represents 90% of the ice on Earth and would raise sea levels worldwide by over 200 feet were it to melt. East Antarctica has been quiescent for centuries upon centuries until now. It's the one piece of the climate puzzle that scientists don't want to see turn ugly so fast, but is misbehaving very, very badly and sending up smoke signals that humanity best get its act together soon and halt CO2 emissions. Not only is the big kahuna of East Antarctica starting to shake, rattle, and roll, its kissing cousin West Antarctica has already been on a roll for some time now. The mass balance of the Antarctic ice sheet from 1992 to 2017 shows the rate of ice loss from West Antarctica increasing threefold over the past 15 years. That's a lot. No science models came close to predicting that rate of increase. But it was and still is happening at an ever-increasing rates of speed. Time and again, the same storylines about scientists surprised by how much faster the climate is changing, way ahead of the models, should start sinking in that anthropogenic climate change is on the march in a big way. According to James Hansen of Earth Institute, Columbia University, whose strong ethical straightforward honesty was totally unacceptable, actually taboo, for the Bush-Cheney administration, the last time the ice sheets disintegrated 14,000 years ago, sea level went up on average 1 meter every 20 years. Totten's early warning signal clanging loud and clear. Somebody, somewhere, everywhere better start planning to move to higher ground or building dikes or do something other than sit around waiting for additional stronger evidence that impending worldwide chaos is right around the corner. Wipeouts are never anticipated. If it were otherwise, they'd never happen. That was an article by Robert Hunziker entitled An Unforeseen Climate Beast Awakens. Robert Hunziker is a journalist for Counterpunch and lives in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Tom. Next up, we're going to hear from Bill Resnick talking with Larry Kleiman, co-founder of PICUN, Oregon Farm Workers Union. They'll be discussing the big picture of immigration reform, activism, and the power of the people. Bill?
Larry Kleiman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here again.
Larry knows immigration and farm work, too. He co-founded PICUN, the Oregon Farm Worker Organization. For 40 years, he spent a lot of time all over the state on ranches and farms, organizing, and in Woodburn, helping run the organization. In his spare time, he lobbied the Oregon legislature, did countless trainings, developed farm worker housing around Woodburn, raised money, developed legal support organizations, and established radio, KPCN, Spanish language. It has a huge audience because of its reports and alerts about action and enforcement. Then over the last 5 years, PICUN has transitioned to a new day-to-day leadership, and Larry, while still advising and working in Woodburn, has begun working on the national scene. Today we'll talk about the big picture, Trump, his strengthening the anti-immigrant movement, his impact on immigrants, but also the pro-immigrant movement, their responses, and their gains, mostly at the state and local level, and what they're doing now. So, Larry, why don't you start with Trump and the anti-immigrant movement?
Well, you know, it's not a new narrative. Trump gained office by appealing to racism and especially xenophobia, the insecurity of white working people and white people in general. I like to say right now that the way I describe the moment we're in is using the analogy of the three walls of Trump. And we have the physical wall, which, of course, isn't even a wall, right? But that's been the point in contention. The visible wall, the tangible wall, is actually now simply been reduced to a monument to his ego and a symbol of racism and exclusion. So we will never have the physical barrier that he's describing for a zillion reasons. He's violating all norms in order to try to convince people that he can achieve it. But really what it has morphed into is the monument to his ego and a symbol of of white supremacy and of exclusion. So then the second wall of Trump is an invisible wall also, and this is a wall to exclude immigrants through fear and through attacks, legal attacks and other forms, to not take advantage of benefits that this society affords them and that their own taxes pay for, whether that's social safety net benefits, immigration benefits, citizenship. It's called the second wall. It's sort of a symbol of all of those forms of exclusion, rhetorically, policy-wise, that his administration and he himself has promoted. The third wall of Trump is a wall that the ultra-right has around him that makes it such that Trump, the ultimate opportunist, so-called deal-maker, person of no particular convictions, is now cornered in a way and walled in, if you will, that he cannot escape from the political trap he has now set for himself.
Yeah, he needs his base to influence the Republican Party. If he doesn't keep those people aroused and voting for his candidates in primary elections, he's dead meat.
And for him in the re-election campaign.
And if he runs for re-election.
Exactly.
I have some doubts whether he will. If he lost them, he would be the lamest of lame ducks. They
exactly.
Would then revolt against him. There's no question.
And yet, his continuing relentlessly to push this wall idea drives away other folks, right?
Yes.
Alienates other folks. The wall is highly unpopular in the national populace, as is the National Emergency Declaration, which is completely bogus, right, and will be enjoined by the courts. So that's the third wall of Trump. The first wall is the monument. The second wall is the invisible barrier for immigrants. The third wall is the constraint of the ultra-right and the agitation of his base around him.
Yeah, he is driving away people with the wall. But if he can somehow stimulate the economy sufficiently at the end, he might, in fact, even be able to be reelected if he runs. So we're still a ways away from the day of reckoning for those people.
Right.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM. I'm talking to Larry Kleinman, a co-founder of Picun, who has for the last, 5 or 10 years, Larry has been working also at the national level, at the states levels, working with others around the country to build power for the documented and undocumented Hispanic population of the country under attack. But in a larger sense, all of the suppressed groups, even people without documents but without any power. So, Larry, let's talk about the undocumented immigrants and the pro-immigrant immigration movement.
Well, for one thing, because there's so many sharp attacks and such a high level of fear, we lose sight of the fact that the general sentiment in the country is actually moving in our direction in spite of that. There's much more, I think, awareness that immigrants are a good thing for this country. They contribute. And ironically, Trump's rhetoric being so over the top and counterfactual has caused there to be some notice, at least, of what the facts actually are. And it reaches people who didn't know what the facts were at all right before that.
Do you think that's it, or is it sort of sympathy? One of the things, he's losing that propaganda war a little bit because of the pictures of babies and children crying and frightened by what's happening to them and their parents. Those things are quite powerful, actually. How far in the population do they really go, though? I think people have turned against it, but some of it is sentimental. And you suggested that also some of it, though, was an understanding of why people immigrate, who they are, how the U.S. has been implicated in that, in people having to come from these failed states, gangster states now, that the U.S. has made into that, actually, through coups, like in Honduras. And now, of course, in Venezuela, but also prior to that in the other countries, Guatemala, Panama even, all of them. I don't know if they know the history or... And not only that, they've been lured into the United States even by the big meat packers, especially, who always needed labor.
Well, I think the narrative has been sketchy and incomplete,
yeah,
or even distorted. we're a long ways away from broad understanding of the fuller narrative you just outlined. But I think that there's more appreciation for the fact and more acceptance of the fact that people are fleeing for their lives. There may not be clarity about why all they're fleeing or whose responsibility it ultimately is. There has always been broad support for immigrants, but it's been a shallow support. There has always been deep opposition to immigrants, and it was a narrow strand. So I think what's starting to shift, that's just as deep as ever, and Trump, of course, has deepened it. But I think it's the reaction to Trump and his approach and his rhetoric has actually made the support for immigrants somewhat deeper. And in the Democratic Party, a more progressive trend in the Democratic Party also applies to immigration. But it didn't start with Trump. It started 20 years before that. Anyway, all those forces are coming together. And now, especially at the national level in the form of the House of Representatives, that will soon be passing measures that state, rather modestly at first, but clearly, where the Democratic Party stands, defending Dreamers, defending people with TPS, temporary protected status, defending people the rights of asylum, right? Of course, those will go nowhere in the Senate, and never mind getting to Trump's desk because he would veto them. But they begin to be the statements of what is the path of repair. The second level nationally is the lawsuits, which continue on. Very important one that will be that we just heard something in development on is the lawsuit against putting a question on citizenship on the census for 2020. We won that case at the district court level in a trial in federal court in Brooklyn, and the Supreme Court has just accepted an emergency appeal, skipping the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit and going straight to the Supreme Court, where there'll be argument the second week of April and a decision in May or June about
the census.
About the question on the census.
That's a very important issue.
Absolutely.
Actually, very important in terms of national politics.
Right.
I'm a little bit afraid of having the Supreme Court making important decisions.
Well, it's a bad sign that they would suddenly take the case. Why would they be doing that if they...
Oh, because it wasn't joined.
It wasn't joined, exactly.
Right.
Anyway, so that's an example, the lawsuits. Yeah. But in general, the lawsuits have been very successful, right?
Yeah.
The third area, though, is also at the state level. We see it here in Oregon, where there will be a bill introduced shortly to restore access to driver's license. That same... campaign is being waged in the state of New York with the new progressive majority and leadership in the state legislature, in the state of New Jersey as well, and in other states around the country that haven't restored driver's license access.
Well, and California really leads in a lot of the pro-immigrant
absolutely
legislation.
And California had already passed it
right.
some years ago,
yeah.
Colorado. In any event, there was an effort in Virginia. The current political crisis there may derail it. But what we're seeing is a high level of activism, energy, and success, or prospect for success at the state level.
Going back to that larger picture of both Democrats and Republicans moving towards a pretty militant neoliberal agenda, as NAFTA, which was a Clinton administration production, and Obama also, as a Democrat, really led the Republicans in terms of the number of people deported from the United States. He was a deporter-in-chief.
2010 is when people started using that term.
Relying on the Democrats doesn't seem to me a really good idea, although maybe things have changed. Tell us about the employers. The employers really got hurt for a while. They were screaming. They didn't have labor, right? Dairy farmers were sacrificing their cows because there was no one to feed and milk them, and you might as well sell them for the meat, right? I know they were shocked when they lost control of immigration policy.
No, that's a good point. And to the point about the Democrats for a minute, which is I think that there's a trend to move left in the party compared with past decades. I think that's also a product of immigrant organizing itself and communities of color organizing, demanding a different politics in the party. I heard a statistic recently that 43% of registered Democrats are people of color. And in the Clinton period, it was half that. So I think immigration has become part of that broader trend, which is reshaping the politics in the Democratic Party. There's still a struggle in the party about that. There's so-called moderates and much more radical folks. In the employer side, in the Republicans, is a fascinating story because the employers of immigrants— those industries dominated by immigrant labor have long considered themselves and been ascendant as shapers of Republican Party politics, leadership, et cetera, and feel completely dispossessed by the twisted populism of Trump, who has basically conducted a hostile takeover from their point of view of their party, the party that they thought they owned with all of their privilege. And so they are in the political wilderness, as they feel, and they're incredibly vulnerable, as you just said.
I mean, if Trump, in fact, wasn't able to win primary elections or threaten incumbents severely, my guess is that they would bounce back in a second and try and change policy. But how have they managed to survive? You don't see bank. Well, there's a lot of dairy farmers are going out of business, but not because of labor, I don't think. But have they been able to assemble a workforce in those meatpacking companies? Or maybe ICE is that they made a deal with ICE. You leave us alone. I'm not sure if that's going on. In some states, it may well be that they're protected.
Well, let's start from the fact that ICE is a dysfunctional organization to begin with, and it's badly led, even in anti-immigrant prism under in the Trump years. And so the truth is everybody knows that ICE will not be everywhere all the time. However, where ICE does show up, they will show up in try to show up in a visible way to project as much fear as they possibly can. But after a while, people realize, well, I may have the bad luck as a worker or an employer of having ICE show up at my workplace, right? But as a statistical question, that's not actually very likely to happen. And so if I'm in the middle of nowhere of Idaho, if they don't happen to have my number for some reason, why they're targeting me, chances are I can sort of carry on and hope to make it to another into another environment in the future.
And the workers there too, but of course the workers have developed surveillance groups, right, and alert groups. If anything icy appears on the horizon, people do not go to work, right? They hunker down, and I suspect
they may try. And some places that's effective, and some places not. Yeah. And some places there's nowhere to go.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And if you're, again, if your idea of the dairy farmer is a great example, because there's a fixed location and you have to milk the cows every day. You can't do it alone. And so if workers suddenly don't show up because they have word of a raid or they're afraid or whatever, you know, you're in terrible trouble quickly. Now, back to the state level, though, just like we were talking about the pro-immigrant expression on the state level, there was a very interesting race in Idaho that I was aware of, for governor of Idaho in the 2018 election, in which Raul Labrador, a Tea Party congressman from northern Idaho, ran in the primary for governor. And he's one of the anti-immigrant leaders in the Congress when he was there. He ran in the Republican primary. The establishment Republicans, led by the dairy operators, mobilized everything they could in their power to defeat him in the primary, even getting Democrats to re-register as Republicans in order to vote against him, and succeeded in nominating the pro-business lieutenant governor, Brad Little, who's now the governor of Idaho. So to your point about primaries, I think there is huge fear in the establishment Republican world of the base that and the sway that Trump has in certain races, but there have also been some examples where either the establishment was able to defeat the anti-immigrant Trump forces, or as in Kansas, we saw Chris Kobach, the poster child of national anti-immigrant leadership, who beat the
and voter suppression
and God knows what all else.
Yes.
Every horror show you can imagine. He defeated a Republican incumbent nominee for governor and then lost the governorship to a Democrat in the general election. So it's a mixed bag, is my point, inside the Republican Party. But there's still huge fear of the command that Trump has over the majority of the Republican base.
Yeah, this is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Larry Kleinman, co-founder of Kuhn, and knows a great deal about the immigration struggles in this country now, worked at both national and local levels. So, Larry, it seems to me ultimately immense attention to the upcoming presidential election is building now. It certainly will have an effect, as did the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. It had a huge impact on how Washington works. People are looking forward to defeating Trump as well as, I suppose, winning a Democratic Congress. It's not inconceivable. I'm somewhat dubious, and I'm also very dubious in that the more than half of the Democratic Party incumbents are quite conservative people, actually. They're new liberals. They're committed to it. They don't know any other system. They've grown up in a period as local politicians where you give huge tax breaks to companies to keep them in your state. That's every state, every city does the same thing. Every public official, their major thing is to keep their employment up in their area. If they don't, they're out of office and humiliated. It's interesting that they're still left, actually, in the Democratic Party with the pressures that are on. It seems to me that that whole set of incumbents and the party, clearly immigration policy will change. It won't be Trumpism. It'll be probably a return to what we had in not too long ago, which was not very good. It seems to me there has to be huge public support. Even if the Democrats won, public support has to be mobilized around something like the Green New Deal, which in mm-hmm. fact did have a few planks in it. I mean, the resolution that Ocasio-Cortez and Markey promoted, it did mention, in fact, immigrant labor. It seems to me there's a possibility of building that kind of broad public support. How do you see that happening, though?
Well, I see the elements coming together. I think it is, you hit it right on the head, which is while the primary force that will drive the 2020 election will be the referendum on Trump and Trumpism, if Trump himself is not the nominee, it's not enough that coming together around a vision and a proposal for what it is we want, even if it'll take a while to achieve, because there's so much to restore, repair, and rebuild, as I like to say, it's going to take the entire decade of the 20s. But so I see the elements coming together around what that would be and that there needs to be that. What I would say to listeners, watch carefully what the House Democrats tee up as immediate bills under the immediate repair agenda, because you could well imagine, as you said, if the Democrats win the White House, win the Senate, that's a lift, but they might be able to do it, retain the House. I think they will do that. That's exactly what we'll see right out of the gate in 2021. You reduce the fear, reduce the threat, the immediate threat that Trump has ginned up both executive action and rhetoric. And then the broader discussion open the space for the broader discussion of what should our immigration system look like in light of all the changes that we've seen in labor markets, in communities, in the flow of peoples around the world, humanitarian obligations, climate change. It's a lot to wrestle with. And frankly, we have not fundamentally updated our immigration laws in either 30 years or more like almost 60 years, depending on how which part of the laws you're talking about. So it's a big discussion. The form exactly of what it'll take to equivalent to or part of a Green New Deal is not yet taken full shape. But I think by the time we get to 2021, there'll be a lot more to share and to consider.
Yeah, the climate crisis, I see that as a determining factor over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years.
Absolutely.
There's going to be a great need for labor, and it's going to have to be international. Countries' borders are going to, in some ways, dissolve because every country has to be involved in some way or another.
And they will be tested by the flows of people who cannot survive wherever they live today.
That also. Anyway, we're moving towards that crisis, it seems to me, and the immigration issue will be front and center for all of these years. Larry Kleinman, very good talking to you today.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you again and look forward to another conversation. There'll always be a lot to talk about on the question of immigration.
Yes. Well, the question of immigration is really the question of how humanity is going to organize itself and with the borders as a sort of demarcation line of some of the political struggles.
It's functioned politically and in every other way as the intersection of everything.
Yeah. thanks a lot for talking to us today, Larry.
Great to be here.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman for their discussion of immigration politics currently. We're now going to turn our focus to a movement of the past with relevance to our present. DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, Portland chapter, is set to host a movie night beginning Women's History Month. That's March 3rd. Made in L.A. is the film, and it is an Emmy Award-winning documentary film and will be shown on Sunday, March 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m. to 9:30, as part of Portland's Democratic Socialists of America's Movie Night series. You can find information on that on Facebook. I would just do DSA Movie Night, and you'll get right there. Made in L.A. is, quote, a story about immigration, the power of unity, and the courage it takes to find your voice. Discussion panel will follow this 70-minute film. It's a $5 to $10 sliding scale donation, but no one will be turned away. You can get tickets online at the Facebook event site or at the door. Made in L.A. is directed by Spanish filmmaker Almudena Carrasado. And she attended UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television. In a 2009 article, Made in L.A., funded from all over, producer Robert Bahar writes, quote, Made in L.A. began when Almudena read a newspaper article about sweatshops in Los Angeles. It talked about deplorable conditions faced by immigrants working in some downtown garment factories, long hours, sub-minimum wage or no pay, and unsafe, unsanitary conditions. Shocked that this was happening in the U.S., she set out to make a short educational video that would expose these issues and would take about 5 months to complete, or so she thought. She approached Los Angeles's Garment Worker Center, then newly opened, and started spending time there, sometimes filming, often just talking with workers. She's speaking in her native Spanish. Being a woman and working alone, she gradually established trust. The workers had just launched a boycott campaign, and there was much to film. Over 5 years, our documentary Made in L.A. grew from a short educational video into a featured documentary that would premiere on PBS primetime series Point of View in 2007. Hundreds of educational and community screenings followed the broadcast. But Made in L.A.'s journey really began in the living rooms and gardens of its core audience, individuals with a passion for social justice, fair trade, women's issues, labor, and immigrants' rights. They reached out to their communities and made this journey possible. That was Robert Bahar, producer of Made in L.A. I want to mention also that the program organizers are DSA members Kara Hansen, Candy Herrera, and Keith Guthrie. They have all been involved in bringing this to a screen near you, Clinton Street Theater. I did ask member and union organizer for the Washington Teachers Union, Candy Herrera, to share her thoughts on Made in L.A. as a relevant teaching tool for some 12 years later from its initial release. The following is her response. The first thing that struck me in the beginning of the documentary was Maria Pineda's description of working in the garment industry, akin to the experience of many white ethnics working in sweatshops at the turn of the century. Particularly the recollection of working without breaks or food with doors locked, the latter of which provoked one of the biggest incidents of garment worker mass death, which was the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire. Another reflection from the film is that the threat of deportation looms in the background, but never really made present. This is in stark contrast with the realities faced by immigrant activists in the present day, many of whom are being targeted and deported for their activism. As a formerly undocumented immigrant, I can attest that the fear of deportation never really goes away, but can only imagine the fear that modern-day activists are going through. We used to say that being outspoken and creating a support base as a result is actually what saves you from deportation. I don't know if that is truly the case anymore. In terms of building socialism, it's hard not to sound like I'm repeating tired tropes, but the fact of the matter is that we cannot build socialism unless we center the voices of the most oppressed in our organizing. This includes immigrant and, most importantly, Black women on the margins of society, and use them as a touchstone for how our movement is developing. These are the words of organizer and event organizer Candy Herrera. She liked to also share a quote from James Baldwin, which I agree really encapsulates where we stand today and what we need to do to bring about this better world. Quote, "If one really wishes to know how justice is administered in a country, one does not question the policemen, the lawyers or judges, or the protected members of the middle class. One goes to the unprotected, those precisely who need the law's protection most, and listen to their testimony. Ask any Mexican, any Puerto Rican, any Black man, any poor person. Ask the wretched how they fare in the halls of justice, and then you will know, not whether or not the country is just, but whether or not it has any love for justice or any concept of it. It is certain in any case that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have." That's James Baldwin from No Name in the Street. This is Denise Morris. I want to just remind folks that I was talking about Made in LA, which will be showing at the Clinton Street Theater on March 3rd. You'll be able to get that information on Facebook, DSA Movie Night. And I want to thank our contributors this morning, Larry Kleinman, our guest, and Glenn Ford, Laurie Mercier, Bill Resnick, and Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer. Coming up on KBOO, we have Locus Focus. Host Barbara Bernstein talks with artist and activist Kalila Farrell-Smith about how tribes are leading the struggle to stop Jordan Cove. Health and Fitness is at 11, and Voice for the Animals at 11:30. Thank you. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour.